When I announced my sermon topic, When It Pays to Steal, someone remarked to me that they were interested in seeing who would be in Temple for the first time this year. And I answered that I wouldn't begin to worry unless they brought in a notebook. But actually, I want to, not to, of course, lay out a scheme for theft, but simply to make a few observations that come to mind as I've watched the reporting of the gold rush of 1968. I wonder if you've been as intrigued as I have been by the rather non-judgmental reporting of the event. We've had a spate of solemn analyses and of serious articles which described for us the mechanics of the international money market, which gave us a brief history of how gold came to play a role as the standard, a measure of value. We've had a rash of statistics about trade balances and cash flow in and out of nations. And all of this, of course, is relevant, and all of it is meaningful. But I've yet to see a single headline or caption of a picture or article which began with the simple, unvarnished, unadorned truth. It might have read something like this. Like pigs in a trough, the commissioners of the wealthy elbowed each other today on the Paris Bourse, trying to get more riches for their clients without working for it. Seeking to exploit an anachronism in the international monetary exchange, these agents of the plutocrats of the world were willing to put into jeopardy the international trade, tens of thousands of jobs, seeing a chance to multiply their wealth without exertion or cost to themselves. And those who pull off these machinations are called shrewd dealers. I confess I am not quite sure what the word shrewd applies to, because actually what they're doing is one of the oldest, most uninventive of the tricks of the schemes known to men. It's precisely the economic coup that Joseph pulled off in the portion from the Bible I read to you this morning. What'd he do? He found a commodity in short supply. He was able to predict a famine. He bought up all of the excess grain and corn in Egypt. And then when the famine came and everyone had to turn to the granaries of the Pharaoh, and Pharaoh could charge whatever he wished. And if anyone wasn't willing to pay the price, they were able to starve. There is no quick profit without someone suffering for it. There are very few killings in the money markets which don't kill some innocent bystander. That's the meaning of the Pharaoh story, the Joseph story. And I suspect that is the deeper implication of the gold rush. It's good to be paid for what you do. And most of what we do has social benefit, and society should pay for it. But there is no benefit in exploiting a quirk in the monetary system. No one stands to gain. It means only that you have inherited or somehow gained a sufficient pile of money that you can put it aside, hoard a commodity which is in short supply, needed, and that when the value of that commodity is raised into a sufficient point, you will allow others the privilege of buying it for you at a much higher price. And of course, you never ask yourself, how much am I taking from the food budget, from the clothing budget, from the educational budget of every home when I demand an exorbitant price for what I have? You never ask yourself, am I jeopardizing the very touchy and very sophisticated relationships of trade between the states? Is my action perhaps causative of a convulsion in the trade markets? And is what I'm doing perhaps the first nail in the coffin of a world recession? And I marvel at the ability of our national press, of our media, to comment on these kinds of greed without making judgments about them. I marvel at our ability to analyze tables and statistics and financial analyses without passing judgment on what's going on before our eyes. For those of us who believe in the possibility of progress, of justice, of peace, have surely been given pause by the events of the last week for a halt is something less than a human being. And if we are to have peace in our times and justice in our world, then there must be some evidence somewhere, someplace, among some people that man can rein in his cupidity, that he can discipline his greed, that he will not be hypnotized and mesmerized by a sallow-colored mineral which is mined by the earth with great difficulty and apparently has no greater use than to be placed back into the earth for security. But of course, having said this, we must also recall an old Yiddish proverb to the effect that not the mouse, but the hole is the thief. If there were not these anomalous situations within the field which is called international exchange, if gold was treated as a commodity like unto any other commodity and not as the currency, then we would not have given to these greedy capitalists, to these greedy wealthy men, the opportunity to make a killing at our expense. And I've been fascinated by man's inability to cut himself loose from what is, after all, a fatal fascination with gold, and to create a system of international exchange, of script, which will truly reflect the various values of various currencies, of various economies. For we can understand how in one year this economy is more stable than this one, and how the relative value of the currencies will change from month to month, if not date from day to day. That's understandable to us. We can understand inflation. We can understand recession. We can understand unfavorable trade balances. We can understand the cost of producing a product. All this makes sense. But if there is this rather pure exchange, then there will not be sudden jumpings up and down, the kinds of traumatic change which cause recessions, cause tremendous confusion. What I do not understand is how this cold-eyed, rational group of people who call themselves bankers or financiers have allowed themselves to be boxed into a position where gold has become the standard of value and where patently there is not enough gold for it to be a standard of value. There is simply not enough gold in the world to base on it the volume of currency needed to manage the trade relationships between nations and between companies and individuals. And yet here we are, bound to a gold standard, or at least partially bound to it, having created an artificial situation which will be exploited again and again and again by the unscrupulous and by the greedy, until we destroy what a fascination with gold, which is as old as man himself. And I wonder about it. You know, the longer I read our Bible, the more I am impressed by its prescience. In the days of Moses, many commodities were used as standards of value. There was no currency as yet, no minted money. There was no script. Men used bullion, gold or silver or copper. Men used spices, silk clothing, dyes, salt. A variety of commodities were used as tokens of exchange. But even in that early day, men remarked upon man's mesmerism how gold had mesmerized man. After all, what's the most fatal fascination of man? What's the first idol around which men danced? A golden calf. It could have been a silver calf, it could have been a ruby calf, it could have been a calf that burnt incense, a candled calf. But no, it was a golden calf. Men have been fascinated by gold since time immemorial. There's no ancient civilization, Sumerian, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, Etruscan, Hebrew, in which gold did not play a significant role. Not only because it was a malleable metal which could be turned into jewelry, but because men somehow felt that here was the metal, the standard of value. And we have from very earliest time evidence that men mined gold and buried gold in their banks and in the ground in order to provide them security. Now, how did this all come about? Suppose if we were to be unromantic historians, we'd have to say simply that gold is a metal which appears most often in its native state. It's rarely mixed with other metals. It's rather unalterable. And that some child man saw a vein of gold ore, and he noticed that the sun shimmered off of it. There was glitter here. And that glitter, I suspect, was the first hypnotic effect that gold had for man, and has continued to have ever since. And so gold is used by Abraham as a standard of merchandising value. When Pharaoh wants to appoint Joseph as his second in command, he puts upon his neck a golden chain. Gold is constantly referred to in the ancient histories as the ultimate gluttony, the ultimate greed, that which man wants most. You have the kings, like Maecenas, who want everything they touch to turn to gold. You have gold as man's most fatal fascination. And you have the prophets, of course, attacking, seeking to scissor men away from this hypnotic effect of gold. The prophet says this, "Gold and silver will not avail thee in the day of the wrath of God. You cannot satisfy your body with gold. You cannot satisfy your soul with gold. Moreover, it is through gold that man stumbles in his iniquity." I quote to you Ezekiel. But the theme is repeated again and again in Scripture. And I suspect the prophets are saying two things to their generation and to us. The first is this. Foolish man, what leads you to believe that gold is a useful commodity? Can you eat gold? Can you wear gold? Can gold give you security? Can gold give you beauty? Why do you come to, what makes you believe that gold has an intrinsic value in and of itself? But you believe this, and believing it, you come to the second failing, and that is to direct your lives towards getting gold, mining it, gaining it, cornering it, having it. And when you have it, having broken every rule in the book to gain it, what have you gotten? Let me illustrate these two themes with two stories from the tradition. The first is a story from the Midrash, the story of a flute, a lovely, simple reed flute, a flute that was played by one of the priests in the Temple of Jerusalem at the time of the great sacrifices. And such was the melody of this flute, such was its tone, that it became particularly beloved and was reserved for the great moments of the sacrifice. The people looked forward to the playing of this instrument. And there came along one day a priest who was more pious than wise, and he looked at this flute, one of the most treasured possessions of the temple, and he said, "Surely we ought to gild the flute. We ought to make it magnificent in exterior as it is magnificent in its tone." And he gave the flute to the goldsmiths, and the goldsmiths worked long on it, and they made a perfect filigree for it and decorated it with jewels and gilded it. And it was returned to the temple. And it was glorious in the hands of the priest. But when he put it to his lips, the tone which had been melodious and harmonious was now harsh, metallic. What leads us to believe that gold adds value, or that gold is a value? It's hard for us to believe or to remember, but at the height of the Depression, when the machinery, the economics of this country was at a near standstill, we had half as much gold in our treasury as we have today. Before all that gold, we couldn't put the economy back in shape. We couldn't make it move. It wasn't sound. We couldn't turn the gold into products, to jobs, for all that we had it buried in Fort Knox in the earth. You can exchange gold for cosmetics, but not for youth. You can exchange gold for food, but not for taste. You can exchange gold for lust, but not for love. You can exchange gold for service, but not for friendship. Gold has no ultimate value. Sometimes society gives it a conventional value. But these things which are truly important, wisdom and love and friendship and dignity and a sense of purpose, these are without price, and they have no golden price. But strange is it not that even faith, when it comes to crystallize and to synthesize the basic moral demands placed upon man, can speak only of a golden rule. The golden rule is really a simple rule, a humble rule. But we have to glorify it, and we assume immediately that anything that is glorious must be golden. You ever looked at a gold brick? It's sallow, mustard-colored. I don't even see any intrinsic beauty in it. It's hardly the most glorious of metals or things that we work into jewelry. But here it is. Even faith cannot resist the temptation of assuming that that which is valuable must necessarily be golden. How wrong they are. The story is told of one of the hard-headed businessmen of our age who likes to believe that everybody has a price. With gold, you can buy anybody and anything. And he said, I'll give $10,000 to anyone who can show me something that doesn't have its price. And someone sat down for him and wrote four things. A baby's smile. The love of a good woman. Youth when it's gone. An entrance into heaven. There are many things which have no price, and the most glorious of things, most desirable of things which we have in life, cannot be bought for gold. But most of us are foolish enough to forget this. Gold does buy many things. Take gold to a store and you can get a fur coat, or you can get an expensive car, you can buy an expensive house. Gold seems to answer all problems, or as an old folk proverb has it, golden bullets hit all the targets. Well, that's nonsense. But most people assume it to be truth. And because they do, they set out single-mindedly to get gold. And what happens along the way? They forget themselves, they forget their families, they forget their health, they forget all perspective, all balance. They're out to get it, to make it, to make a killing. And sometimes they manage to kill themselves. In the Confucian Treasury of Wisdom, the story is told of a fine Chinese mandarin, a merchant, solemn, hardworking, who devoted himself to providing for himself and for his family. But the need to provide became a need to have. And the more he had, the more he wanted. He became hypnotized by the need to get more wealth, more gold, and more gold. But he was fortunate. He became wealthier and wealthier and wealthier. And one day, he was out in the street, and he came to the marketplace, to the goldsmith's alley, and as he was walking down the alley, he suddenly saw piles of gold in one of the goldsmith's benches. And he walked over to that gold in broad daylight in the middle of the bustling marketplace, and he took the gold from the goldsmith's bench, and he put it into his pouch, into his purse, and he walked away with it. And of course, he was apprehended. And the officials who knew him to be wealthy and to be a respected merchant said, how could you do such a thing? Didn't you see all the people? How did you believe that you could get away with stealing gold in broad daylight in the marketplace from this goldsmith's bench? And the merchant answered, I didn't see the people. I only saw the gold. Well, I suspect there are many who, wanting coin, wanting wealth, lose their ability to see other human beings, their wives, their children, and value their honor, their integrity. They see only the gold, and they come to glorify only those who know how to get it. Some years ago, I quoted to you the little doggerel about our modern businessmen. He spent his health to get his wealth, and then with might and main, he spent his wealth to get his health again. It says something about our society, and it says something about those in our society, and it's a gold-oriented society. It says something about all of us who seek so much, and who in the process forget so much. How many men and women come into my office, their homes shredded, because one or the other has been hypnotized by gold. They thought that they could prove their love with a golden purse. They thought they could raise their children by golden gifts. They thought that they could buy themselves position and respect in their communities. And it cannot be done, because love cannot be bought. Love must be earned. And children cannot be bought. They must be trained. And respect cannot be bought. It must be merited. And one merits respect, and one trains children, and one earns love by the kind of person one is, not by the expense of the clothing one wears or the value of the house in which one lives, but simply by the kind of person that we are. The cynics among us say that in every generation, men dance around the golden calf. And I quote to you not a modern cynic, but Abahu, one of the rabbis of the Talmud. The cynics say in every generation, men dance around the golden calf, and I suspect that there is truth to this. But I suspect also that in every generation, there are those who recognize the importance of earning a living, of providing for one's family, but who recognize also that there are other things which must be earned and other things which must be made provision for. And that gold is not the golden ladder to success, to fame, and to happiness. You read a strange comment in the Talmud. The rabbis were nonplussed by the fact that gold could be transformed into food, or transformed into a trip, or transformed into a home. After all, it's gold, not currency. It's gold and nothing more. And they said, somehow this gold must be some of God's magic. Otherwise, how account for it? But magic, they say, is forbidden. And by that, they were saying to us two things. The first, to treat gold as a commodity like unto any others. If you must have a piece of gold jewelry, have it. But certainly don't build the basis of a world economic system on a commodity which is not in sufficient supply to be adequate to your needs. And secondly, not to set such value by your pocketbook, by your income. People can get by if we work and if we try. And you know the difference in the standard of living of a man who earns a modest income and a man who earns a tremendously high income is very little in our day and age. You can't really tell how much people have by where they live or how they dress or where their children go to school, because there are subsidies and there are scholarships and there are any number of ways in which a rather righteously oriented society has made it possible for ordinary people to live with decency. Gluttony today no longer pays off. And gluttony always destroys, shortens the life, destroys the integrity of the man who is a pig. And so there you have it. An ancient fascination, the golden calf. So there you have it. A so-called golden rule, which I'd like to call a rule of the earth. Simple rule. To live with some good sense. To set out real, honest, human values. To make these the focus of your life. Rather than cornering markets or killing, making quick killings in some commodity. Getting rich quick schemes. Live with purpose. Live with quality. Live with dignity. These are the values, the basic values, man. Amen.